Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore. Molly Ringwald took the stage at age 3, and her film career began 10 years later with her Golden Globe-nominated performance in The Tempest. Her extensive film credits include such little-known films as Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles, and The Breakfast Club. Molly has starred in the Broadway production of Cabaret and the Tony-nominated production of Enchanted April, among others. She can currently be seen on ABC Family's hit The Secret Life of the American Teenager. Her writing has also been widely published, and she's the author of the best-selling Getting the Pretty Back. We're delighted that Molly Ringwald is here tonight in Denver to present her fiction debut, When It Happens to You. Would you please join me now in making Molly Ringwald feel welcome?
What a great crowd. Thank you so much for coming out to support me and also to support your independent bookstore, The Tattered Cover. This is the very end of my official U.S. book tour. And all the authors that I know who have looked at my schedule say, you're going to love Tattered Cover. It's the best. So I really feel like I'm just going out with a bang. So thank you very much for joining me. I would like to tell you a little bit about my book, When It Happens to You, for those of you who haven't read anything about it. It is a novel and stories, and it's along the theme of betrayal, but all different kinds of betrayal, not just the garden variety betrayal. but it does start out with a marital betrayal, and then each subsequent story it explores a different kind of betrayal. From how many times can I say betrayal in 5 minutes? Let's see. Start counting. There's a betrayal of a mother to her child. There's betrayal, an artistic betrayal. The part that I would like to read to you tonight is about a betrayal of a mother to her child. Actually, I don't have a copy. This is a little bit of the third story in the collection, and it's called My Olivia. Oliver was just shy of 4 years old when he asked his mother to buy him a dress for the first time. It was a simple red shift, almost a tunic, with a band of metallic rickrack just above the hem. But something in the color or the cut or the way that it was modeled on the fiberglass child-sized mannequin in the boutique window made it unmistakably a dress. Oliver was Marina's only child, the result of an impetuous island holiday she had taken with girlfriends in order to lift her spirits after yet another failed relationship. She had never been to the Caribbean, and her girlfriends, Merle, Trudy, and Una, pooled their funds to splurge for a suite right on the water. It was a raucous, rum-soaked weekend full of girlish, tear-stained confessions and 90-minute massages in the height of hurricane season. When Marina returned to California with stuffy sinuses and a sudden dislike for the smell of coffee, she was sure that she had contracted a bug. Being in her late 30s and never having had anything close to a pregnancy scare, Marina had always assumed that she was simply infertile. But unlike her friends who went from fearing pregnancy to pursuing it, Marina viewed her situation as a convenience or even a luxury since she had never once heard the ticking of her own clock. She assumed that the clock was broken along with her reproductive machinery and didn't concern herself much with it. The inability to sustain a relationship with a man was far more worrisome. It was Trudy who first suggested to Marina that she might be pregnant, after Marina ran to the bathroom twice while watching Trudy feed her baby pureed leftover spaghetti and meatballs with a spoon. It had been just over 3 months since the Barbados holiday. "It is impossible," Marina insisted. "I got my period." "You might want to get a test, just in case," Trudy told her in a sing-song voice. Zachariah was a surprise. "Weren't you my little Zach Pack?" She kissed her boy extravagantly on the mouth and licked the sauce from the sides of her own lips, sending Marina sprinting to the toilet again. That night, she picked up a pregnancy test kit on the way home from the gym and was stunned to see the plus size materialize. She stared at the contraption in disbelief, doubting its accuracy. When the blue cross appeared on the second test, even more rapidly this time, she sat down on the edge of the bathtub, shaking her head. Holding the innocuous-looking piece of plastic in her hand, she was transfixed by the bright blue stain in its tiny window. It was like she found a bruise that had appeared on her body overnight with no knowledge of how or when the injury had taken place. What Marina had assumed to be her menstruation was actually implantation bleeding. The cluster of cells that would later become her son was burrowing into her uterine wall. By the time she discovered the pregnancy, she was already well into her second trimester. Marina was dumbfounded. The thought of becoming a mother was unfathomable to her. She had only ever been vaguely interested in her friend's children, a notable source of contention with her last serious boyfriend. One of their reoccurring arguments had been her patent lack of interest in having a family. "There's something wrong with you," he insisted. "You have the maternal instincts of a black widow." "Black widows eat their mates, not their young," she replied. It was a useless correction, however. She could tell by the sad smile and the way that the corners of his eyes tilted down that it was already over between them. And it was true. Marina had no interest in motherhood. She relished her freedom with a zeal that only grew stronger as she watched her girlfriend's steady marches toward maternity. One by one, their personalities became as disfigured as their bodies. They were perpetually fatigued and unkempt. Their walls were covered with sloppy finger paintings housed in expensive frames, and their speech was taken over by motherese, peppered with the words potty, wee-wee, and wah-wah. One night, Una actually licked her finger and rubbed it across Marina's cheek, only realizing her gaffe when she saw the dumbstruck expression on her childish friend's face. "Oh, sorry, honey," Una laughed. "Mommy's got baby brain." Marina wanted no part of it. As soon as she escaped the mommy brigade, it took 20 minutes on the elliptical until she began to feel like herself again. And then for 5 long months, she watched her body metamorphose into exactly what she disparaged in her friends. The years that she had spent perfecting those twin lines down the sides of her abdomen, the delicate sloping inside toward her navel, she would have to say goodbye to these forever. At night, if she was really quiet, she felt as if she could hear the muscles tearing. Marina followed her obstetrician's advice and ate the minimum amount required to sustain the life of what she viewed as the alien growing inside of her. But even with that, there was no stopping the ruthless expansion. Once she hit the 30-pound mark over her ideal weight, she stopped stepping on the metal and glass bathroom scale. She grew deeply depressed when she could no longer wear her own clothes and yet refused to buy anything that she wouldn't need again, thinking it wasteful. Her friends donated boxes of frumpy, drool-stained maternity clothes to her, which she thanked them for as she resigned herself to the ugly garments. Gritting her teeth, she avoided her own reflection and waited and waited and waited for the reprieve. And then, exactly on the due date, Marina woke up with contractions. 3 hours later, she was holding her 7.5-pound son in her arms, staring in awe as he snuffled around her breast and fastened on with a hungry little rosebud mouth. She had never seen a face so fine and symmetrical in her life. He didn't look anything like her, but very much like the caramel-skinned surf instructor she had rolled around on the beach with during those last nights of her holiday. Her baby had a soft carpet of circles covering his tiny head and gray eyes the color of pussy willows. He was the most beautiful creature she had ever laid eyes on, and Marina was shocked to find herself, at the age of 37, so deeply in love. She named him Oliver. When Oliver was a baby, Marina found herself waking up in the middle of the night, terrified that he had stopped breathing. She stripped his crib of any potential smothering hazards, getting rid of stuffed animals, pillows, bumpers, and blankets. But even with this precaution in place, Marina would find herself in his room night after night, camped out next to his crib, listening for the sweet inhalation and exhalation of his tiny lungs. And despite, or perhaps because of her fears, Oliver thrived. Though not particularly hefty, he hit all of his developmental milestones and was thought to be an exceedingly healthy child. He was breastfed longer than most children and never exhibited anything resembling an allergy. Peanuts, shellfish, soy, dust, dander, nothing threatened him. The only thing to which he demonstrated an adverse reaction was a haircut. Oliver screamed any time a pair of scissors came close to his long, curly hair. The first two words he uttered in sequence occurred when Marina brought him to a children's hair salon for his first haircut. "No, Mommy!" He held out his arms to her. His gray eyes widened in terror. The experienced stylist tried to distract him with cartoons, and when that didn't work, to bribe him with lollipops and Hershey's Kisses. But Oliver continued to howl in protest. When it was clear that Oliver would not submit, Marina scooped him up and paid the woman anyway, over-tipping as she mumbled an embarrassed apology and rushed out of the salon. Now, at 6 years old, Oliver had dark, curly, shoulder-length hair. Marina mastered the French braid so that she could fake a short haircut when necessary, but most of the time, Oliver wore his hair loose in soft, glossy waves that arranged themselves around his delicate face. He was beautiful, but more than that, he was pretty. Marina was used to people asking her the name of her little girl. "His name is Oliver," she would say. "He's a boy," she would add, and smile at the ill-disguised looks of disbelief. She wasn't exactly sure when Oliver became Olivia at home. Most of the time, she called him Ol or Ollie, but just after his fourth birthday, shyly at first, and then with more insistence, he asked that she call him Olivia. "But Oliver, honey, you're a boy." "I want to tell you a secret," he said. They were snuggled in her bed, reading Raggedy Ann in the Deep, Deep Woods. She put the book aside and looked down at him. "Okay, honey, what's the secret?" "Well," he looked nervous and then grinned at her. "I wasn't going to tell you, but you're my mommy." "That's right, hon, I'm your mommy, and you can tell me anything, anything at all." "I'm really a girl," he said in a whisper. She stared at him, wanting to say the right thing, fearing to say the wrong thing. "You may feel like a girl sometimes," she began. "No, I am a girl," he said, his voice rising. She waited a moment for him to calm down, and then gently, she tried again to explain. "Do you remember when we had that talk? How what you have between your legs is different than what mommy has, and my penis is going to fall off," he said. "And when it does, everyone will know that I'm not lying. I'm a girl. My name is Olivia." He put his head down in her lap and cried. She ran her hands through the tangle of his hair and did the only thing that she knew how to do. She comforted him. Thank you. I can take some questions for a little bit before we do the signing, if you have any. Yes. What authors have influenced me? I think so many, but I think probably the author that really made me want to write was Raymond Carver. You're nodding like you know. You knew that. Do you like Raymond Carver? Yeah. You know, before then, I really loved F. Scott Fitzgerald and, of course, J.D. Salinger, like any teenager. And then I discovered Raymond Carver when I was 19 years old on a friend's table when I was a guest in New York. And there was something about his writing, something that I recognized, and It was like a visceral response. It was one of those nights where I couldn't go to sleep. I stayed up all night reading his stories, and I think he really ignited my love of short stories, which is why my first book is a collection of stories. So. Yes. Was it difficult to transition from working around people and to go to writing, which is more of a solitary existence. By the way, the reason why I'm repeating these questions is because this is being podcasted, and they won't be able to actually hear the questions. So I don't normally repeat questions like this, but it was difficult. I've written for years, in addition to acting, but it was something that I did privately, and I didn't know if I would ever actually publish. I did publish a memoir before this one, which kind of seemed sort of more acceptable for it to be an actress or a public person than writing fiction. My husband, who's also a writer, likens it to me sticking my big toe in the water and seeing how the temperature was. And then I thought, oh, okay, people can deal with that. So here's what I really want to do, which is write fiction. But it's always been difficult, I think, for me to I've been acting and performing. I'm also a jazz singer. And I've been doing that since I was 3 years old. So I've always been used to this kind of call and response. I've always known if I was doing something good by the response of the audience or just the energy in the room. And you don't have that as a writer. And I'm very fortunate that my husband is a writer and an editor. So he sort of became my audience of one. Unlike, when he writes, it takes him a long time to share it with me. And me, if I have a good day, then I have to go home and read it out loud. And that's, I'm sure it's because of my acting. It's just, I need that. And I'm lucky that I'm able to... Hi. I'm lucky that I have that in my life. Yes? Where do I get the material for my book? I think it's a combination of things. I feel like I'm sort of a magpie in that I take from everywhere. I take from friends through observation, some of my own life and experience, imagination. I think it's really a combination of everything. When I was thinking about the theme of betrayal, I was thinking that it was a very universal subject, and it might have something to do with the age that I'm at, but I really feel like it's all around us. If you really think about the things that unite us as human beings, there's love, there's hate, there's food, there's betrayal. I think it's really impossible to meet one person and say, have you ever betrayed anyone? Or have you ever been betrayed? Have you ever betrayed yourself? Have you ever known anyone who's been betrayed? The answer, I think, to that would be yes. So, and I'm no exception. I've been on both sides of betrayal in my life, so I feel like I was able to bring some personal experience to that as well. Yes, sir. Which form of betrayal did I find it hardest to write about? I think all of them, really, in different ways. I think... When I'm writing from a female point of view, I think it comes easier because I'm a female. So there are challenges in writing from a male point of view. I also found it challenging because the book starts out with a marital betrayal, and in this case, which I certainly don't want to say this is all cases, because I think men betray women and women betray men and men betray men and women. I don't think it's any sex that betrays or any gender that betrays another more than another. But in this case, it's the man that betrays the woman. And then later in the novel, there's a story that's told from the male point of view. And because I had already set up a lot of stories where you got the female point of view, it was challenging to first write credibly from a male point of view and then also... To find sympathy in him, and that was really important to me. Is I didn't want there to be any villains in this book. There are no villains. Everyone is tremendously flawed, but they're not villainous at all. But I did find it challenging to, you know, that I think to really see the humanity in him and to see that he was suffering along with everyone else. Yes, sir. What was my favorite moment when I worked with John Hughes? There were so many moments. It's hard to pick exactly one. You know, I often call him the sixth member of the Breakfast Club, because when we shot that movie, it was before the video. What they call the video village, you know, where they go off and they watch everything on video. You know, they didn't have that then, and John was always, you know, sitting there right under the camera. I mean, he was this close, and you know, he was like one of us, you know. And there were times during 16 Candles where we would start laughing so hard that they would actually have to pack up and leave the set and go somewhere else and film another scene and then come back to it. I have really fond memories of working with him. Yes.
How do you feel acting and the ability to take on different personas has helped you as a writer with creating viable characters?
How has my acting affected my ability to create character? I feel like it's helped tremendously. I just wrote an op-ed, actually, for the New York Times on that subject, for the draft section called Act Like a Writer. I think that's what they ended up calling it. And it points to that ability that I've had or that I've worked on my entire life, which is understanding character. It's something that's always interested me in acting. I've always judged a screenplay on how interesting and flawed the characters are, because I'm not interested in playing people that aren't human. And it's the same with my writing. You know, I really am interested in what makes people do what they do. You know, why somebody would say one thing and do something else. Why they undermine themselves. Why they hurt the people that they love the most. These are all questions that I think really drive me as a writer, and I think have also driven me as an actress as well. Yes?
I was wondering, how about you as a child? Did you enjoy writing, and was there a particular adult or adults who supported you?
Did I enjoy writing as a child, and was there an adult who supported me? Yes, I did enjoy writing as a child, and my mother supported me a lot, both of my parents, but I would say that my mother supported me more as a writer and my father supported me more as a singer, you know, so I got it from, and then I guess they both supported me as an actress. So I've been very fortunate to have very supportive parents, but, you know, from the time that I learned how to write, just like Matilda, I was writing little stories. You know, I remember the first story that I wrote when we were living in Sacramento, California, where I grew up. My parents were looking to buy a house, and the owners of the house had passed away. And so I wrote a story from the point of view of the ghosts of this house, and imagining, you know, how much they wanted our family to live there. And it was this very involved, you know, story. Unfortunately, somebody else made a higher offer. But that was the first time that I really remember, you know, writing fiction. And I was probably about 6 years old. Yes. How did I feel my parents' support as a writer? My mother always read to me and my brother and my sister at night. And I've always said, when people asked how I learned to write, you know, I really didn't learn from an MFA program or even college, because I didn't go to either one of those as much as I would have liked to. I went to Paris instead. I mean, literally, I was accepted at USC, and I was supposed to go in the fall and then went to Paris before the summer and just couldn't leave. But I really do feel like the way that I learned how to write was through reading great books. And my mom really started me off on that. She used to read to us at night, and then she would get to a really crucial part in the narrative, and then she would hide the book. And so my brother and I, and hide really well, because my brother and I would search everywhere in the house and we would never find it. And then the next night, the book would come out again and she would continue. And I think that really ignited my love of fiction and love of storytelling. And then she just really encouraged me in writing. But she was critical as well. I remember her driving me to work, and I was really heavy into my J.D. Salinger. Not to work, to school. She was driving me to school, and I was finishing a story, and we got to the school, and I read it to her, and she said, "That's just too derivative. You can do better than that. Rewrite the story in your own voice." And she sat there, and I said, "Okay." And I sat there and took, you know, about 15 minutes and rewrote the story. So, and I think that was really valuable for me. We have time for two more questions before the signing. Yes, all the way back there.
So, first of all, I've been a huge fan since I was like 7, and that's like 30 years out. So
thank you.
But also, I'm wondering if you feel more of an inclination towards one art than the other, and also, it's a two-part question, do you feel like it's been hard to transition from your past in acting into these other realms?
Is there an art that I prefer over the other? No, I can't really say that there's one that I prefer over the other. You know, it's like people ask me if I prefer the you know, films or theater or television, and I don't. I want to do it all. And now it's expanded to music and to writing. There's something that I get from acting that I don't get from anything else, and I don't think I'd ever want to give that up. I'll probably become more focused on writing. It's really what I think what drives me more than anything. But then I can't imagine not singing jazz too. You know, I just I don't want to choose, and I don't feel like I have to. You know, I think when I was younger, when I was acting, I kind of thought that was all I could do. That was all that people would allow me to do. And then as I matured, specifically when I turned 40, I think I just, you know, all that goes out the window, and it doesn't, you realize that you're really kind of thinking about other people's expectations of you. You know, I really just have to pay attention to myself and to what drives me and what feels right in my core. And have I found it difficult to transition? No, not really. I mean, you know, some other people, it might give other people vertigo, but to me, it feels completely natural. One last question. Yes.
You said that you were particularly interested in Marina as another character to play in a movie. How do you narrow it down, having written all these characters that I'm sure you're very involved with?
How do I narrow down which character I would like to play? Well, there's really only two women that I could play. There's the main character whose name is Greta, and then there's Marina, and I just feel like I would be better cast as Marina. There's another woman who is 73 years old named Betty, who is the protagonist of The Little One, and depending on how long it takes me to make this movie, I may be more well-suited to Betty, but for right now, I think Marina is the character that I'm most well-suited for. Thank you so much. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.